again, but I think yesterday was the first time I'd seen her in a couple of years, Bosch said. He knew that Lourdes was angling to find out what the visit from downtown the day before was all about, but he wasn't interested in talking about it. He changed the subject. Your son excited about the Dodgers this year? He asked. Oh, yeah, Lourdes said. He picked his games, and I need to get the tickets. He thinks they're going to win it all this year.
About time.
Yeah. You know that Soto's never been to a Dodgers game? Her grandparents and her father were kicked out of Chavez Ravine back in the 50s, and she'll never set foot in that place. She doesn't even like going to the academy. Bosch was talking about the forced relocation of an entire Latino neighborhood to make way for the baseball stadium near downtown. The bitterness of the move, including many tearful and violent evictions recorded on news cameras, still blemished the history of the much-loved team. The LAPD Academy was on the edge of one of the stadium's vast parking lots.
I guess I understand all that, Lourdes said. But it was a long time ago. Baseball is baseball. Like I'm going to deny a little boy his love of baseball because of something that happened before his mother was even born?
His mother's love of baseball, too, Bosch said. He smiled. Before Lourdes could formulate a comeback, they both saw a van turn the corner from San Fernando onto Tarabella. Bosch at first thought it was heading to the sprinkler manufacturer, but it stopped directly in front of the door to the clinic. Bosch and Lourdes watched silently as the side door of the van slid open and people started climbing out and heading to the door of the clinic. Bosch counted 11 people, not including the driver, who remained in the van. They disappeared into the clinic.
So what was that? Lourdes asked.
Got me, Bosch said. Maybe they picked people up at an old folks' home or something.
They weren't all old.
Mostly old. And they looked more like they were homeless than from a home. Bosch nodded and they dropped back into silence as they continued to watch. The van's driver remained in place behind the wheel, and the side door remained open. About 20 minutes after they disembarked from the van, the passengers started coming out of the clinic and getting in line to get back in the van. Bosch looked more closely this time. They were diverse in gender and race, but consistent in the scruffy clothing that hung loose on their bony frames. To Bosch, it looked like a line for a soup kitchen on Fifth Street in downtown.
What do you think? Lourdes asked.
I don't know, Bosch said. What kind of clinic doesn't have a sign out front?
The illegitimate kind.
And those are patients?
Maybe pill shills.
Jerry, the medical board investigator, called them that. They go to the so-called clinic, get a prescription, and then go collect the pills at the pharmacy. They're paid $1 a pill. I guess it's not bad if you're picking up 60 pills a pop.
But then what do the pills sell for on the street?
He said that depends on dosage and what you're buying. Generally, $1 a milligram. Oxycodone scripts usually come in 30-milligram pills. But he said the holy grail of hillbilly heroin these days is the 80-meg dose. Also something called oxymorphone. It's the next big thing. The high is supposedly 10 times as powerful as you get with oxycodone.
Bosch took out his phone and opened up the camera app. Steadying the phone on the dashboard, he started taking photos of the clinic and the van. He used the zoom to get a closer look at the people waiting to climb in, but their features blurred.
You think the van's going to start taking them around to pharmacies now? He asked.
Maybe, Lourdes said. Jerry said old people make the best shills. They're prized.
Why's that?
Because they want people who look old enough to be on Medicare. They give them counterfeit Medicare D cards. They buy the names of legit cardholders, and then they don't have to pay full price for the prescriptions they fill.
Bosch shook his head in disbelief. So Medicare pays the pharmacy back for the drugs, he said. In other words, the federal government finances the operation.
A lot of it, Lourdes said.
According to Jerry. One last man came out of the clinic's door and headed toward the van. By Bosch's count, 12 men and women were now crammed into the back. They were white, black, and brown, the one unifying factor being that they all looked like they had been down rough roads. They had gaunt faces and a shabbiness about them that unmistakably came from the hard life. The driver wearing sunglasses and a black golf shirt got out and went around the front of the van to slide the door closed. By the time Bosch had zoomed in his camera, it was too late to get the shot. The driver was in the van and hidden behind reflections on the windshield.
The van pulled away from the clinic and headed down Tarabella in the direction of the two detectives. Bosch pulled his phone down below the dashboard.
Shit, Lourdes said.
There was no disguising that Bosch and Lourdes were in an unmarked police car. It was black and had government hubs and flashers mounted behind the front grille. But the van went by without slowing, the driver preoccupied with a call on his cell phone. Bosch noticed he had a goatee and a gold ring on the hand that held his phone. Lourdes watched in her side-view mirror until the van went two blocks down to El Dorado and turned right.
"Should we?" she asked.
"Might as well," Bosch said. She pulled the car away from the curb and made a three-point turn. She punched it to get down to El Dorado and made the same turn the van did. They caught up to the van as it made another right at Pierce and then drove north, crossing San Fernando and the metro tracks before entering Whiteman Airport.
"Didn't expect this," Lourdes said.
"Yeah, weird," Bosch added. The van pulled up to a gate across from an entrance to the private hangar area, and the driver's window came down. An arm extended from the window and held a key card to a reader. The gate lifted and the van went through. Lourdes and Bosch couldn't go through, but there was a perimeter road that ran parallel to the internal road and allowed them to follow the van from outside the restricted area. They watched it pull into an open hangar and then lost sight of it from their angle. They parked on the side of the perimeter road and waited.
"What are you thinking?" Lourdes asked.
"No idea," Bosch said. "Let's just see what happens." They watched in silence after that, and a few minutes later, a single-engine plane, its prop a spinning blur, emerged from the hangar and started moving toward the runway. After it cleared the hangar, the van pulled out and headed back toward the gate.
"The van or the plane?" Lourdes asked.
"Let's stay here with the plane," Bosch said. "I have the plate off the van." Bosch counted seven windows running down the side of the plane behind the cockpit. Shades were pulled down inside each window. He pulled a pen and notebook out of his pocket and wrote down the tail number of the plane. He also noted down the time. Then raising his phone again, he started taking photos of the plane as it taxied to the runway.
"What the hell are we looking at here?" Lourdes asked.
"I don't know," Bosch said, "but I got the tail number. If they filed a flight plan, we can get it." Bosch checked the hangar and saw the big, wide door slowly coming down. There was an advertisement in faded paint on the corrugated metal. "Take the plunge. SFV Skydiving Club. Call today. Jump today." Bosch turned his attention back to the runway and watched silently as the plane moved down the tarmac. It was white with a burnt orange stripe running down its side. It had an overhead wing and a jump deck below the outline of a wide passenger door. Bosch switched the camera to video and filmed as the plane picked up speed and then lifted into the air. It flew off to the east and then banked south below the sun. Bosch and Lourdes watched it until it disappeared. Chapter 10. The air traffic control tower at Whiteman was up a staircase from a small general administration building. There was one receptionist between the public and the stairs, and she folded at the sight of the police badges. Bosch and Lourdes went up the stairs and knocked on a door with a sign on it that said ATC, no admittance. A man answered the door and started raising his hand to point to the words no admittance when he too saw the badges.
"Officers," he said, "is this about the drag racers?"
Bosch and Lourdes looked at each other, not expecting the question.
"No," Lourdes said. "We want to ask you about that plane that just took off."
The man turned and looked back into the room behind him and out the window to the airfield as if to confirm he was at an airport and that a plane had just taken off. He then looked back at Lourdes.
"You're talking about the Cessna?" he asked.
"The jump plane," Bosch said.
"Yeah, the Grand Caravan, also known as the minivan. Not much else I can tell you beyond that."
"Is there room in there for us to come in and talk? This is a homicide investigation."
"No, sure. Be my guests."
He held his arm out for them to enter. Bosch pegged him as late 60s with a military background. Something about his bearing and the way he held out his hand like he was snapping off a salute. The tower was a small space with the requisite windows offering a full view of the airfield. There were two seats in front of a radar and communications console. Bosch signaled Lourdes to take one of the seats, and he leaned against a four-drawer filing cabinet next to the door.
"Can we start with your name, sir?" Lourdes said.
The man took the remaining seat after turning it to face the two detectives. "Ted O'Connor," he said.
"How long have you worked here, Mr. O'Connor?" she asked.
"Oh, let's see, about 20 years now, over two different stints. Came here after the Air Force, put in 25 there, dropping napalm and shit on foreign lands. Then I came here for 10, retired, then decided I didn't like being retired, and came back after a year. That was 12 years ago. You might think sitting up here all day is boring, but you try spending a summer in a double-wide with a single-wide AC unit? You want hot and boring? Anyway, who gives a shit, really? You want to know about that Cessna. Do you know how long it's been here?"
"Offhand, I can tell you it's been hangared here longer than I have, and it's changed hands quite a few times over the years. The owner for the past couple years is a company from down in Calexico. At least that's where Betty downstairs tells me the hangar and fuel invoices go."
"What's the name of the company?"
"Betty will have to get you that. She told me, but I don't remember. Cielo something or other. It's a Spanish name, and I don't have much Spanish."
"Is it still used for skydiving?"
"I hope not. The people I see getting on that plane wouldn't make it to the ground alive."
Bosch leaned forward and looked out through the windows. He saw that O'Connor had a direct line of vision into the hangar. The binoculars on the console would give him a close-up view inside when the big door was open.
"So, what do you see going on in that hangar, Mr. O'Connor?" Bosch asked.
"I see a lot of people coming in and out," O'Connor said. "A lot of people as old as, well, me."
"Every day?"
"Just about. I'm only here 4 days a week, but every day that I am, I see that plane either landing or taking off, and sometimes both."
"Do you know if that plane is still configured inside for skydiving?"
"As far as I know."
"Long jump benches on both sides?"
"That's right."
"So how many people can they put in there at once?"
"That plane's a stretch model with a big tail section. You can get 15, maybe 20 in there if you have to."
"Did you ever report what you saw to anyone?" Lourdes asked.
"Report what?" O'Connor said. "What's the crime in getting on a plane?"
"Did they file a flight plan today?"
"They never file a flight plan. They don't have to. They don't even need to check in with the tower as long as they're flying VFR.
VFR? What's that?
Visual flight rules. See, I'm here to provide radar to those who request it and to guide instrument flyers in or out if they need it. Trouble is, you might have noticed we're in California, and if it's sunny out, you're going to go VFR, and there is no FAA rule requiring a pilot to make contact with the tower on a general aviation airfield. The guy flying that caravan today, he said one thing to me, and that was it."
"What was it he said?"
"That he was positioning for an easterly takeoff, and I told him the field was his."
"That's it?"
"That's it, except you said it with a Russian accent. I think because we have a westerly wind today, he was letting me know he was going down to the other end in case I had somebody coming in."
"But how do you know it was a Russian accent?"
"Because I just do."
"Okay. So no flight plan means there's no documentation of where he's going or when he's due back?"
"Not required in an airfield like this and for a plane like that."
O'Connor pointed out the window as though the plane in question were hovering out there. Lourdes looked at Bosch. She was clearly surprised by the lack of security and control of who came in and out of the airport.
"If you think the days are wide open here, you should check this place out at night," O'Connor said. "We close the tower at 8. It's an uncontrolled field after that. People can come in and out as they please, and they do."
"You just leave the runway lights on?" Bosch asked.
"No, the lights are radio controlled. Anybody in a plane can toggle them on and off. The only thing you have to worry about are the drag racers."
"Drag racers?"
"They sneak out onto the tarmac at night and have their races out there. We had a guy coming in here about a month ago, flicked on the lights and almost put it down on top of one of those hot rods."
They were interrupted by a call on the radio, and O'Connor turned to the console to handle it. It sounded like a plane was coming in from the west. O'Connor told the pilot the airfield was his. Harry looked at Lourdes. She raised her eyebrows and Bosch nodded. The message between them was clear. They didn't know if what they were asking about had anything to do with their investigation, but what they had just seen, several men and women transported from the clinic directly to a plane and then flown away without so much as a head count, was highly unusual, and the ease with which it was done was surprising. O'Connor stood and leaned over the console to look through the windows. He picked up the binoculars and held them to his eyes as he looked out.
"We've got one coming in," he said.
Bosch and Lourdes remained silent. Bosch was unsure if he should interrupt O'Connor's observation and handling of the landing. Soon a small single-engine plane came gliding over the airfield from the west and safely landed. O'Connor wrote the plane's tail number down on a log page on a clipboard and then hung it on a hook on the wall to his right. He then turned back to the detectives. "What else can I tell you?" he asked. Bosch pointed to the clipboard.
"You document every takeoff and landing that occurs during business hours?" he asked.
"We don't have to," O'Connor said.
"But we do.
Yes, if we're here."
"Mind if I take a look?"
"No, I don't mind." O'Connor took the clipboard back off the wall and handed it to Bosch. There were several pages documenting the comings and goings at the airport. The single aircraft that made the most takeoffs and landings had the tail number Bosch had written down earlier, the jump plane. He handed the clipboard back. His plan was to officially reclaim it with a search warrant.
"Are there cameras on the runways and in the hangars?" he asked.
"Yes, we have cameras," O'Connor said.
"How long is the video archived?"
"Not sure. I think a month. The LAPD was out here to look at video of the drag racing, and they went back a few weeks, I heard."
Bosch nodded. It was good to know they could come back to look at video if needed.
"So in summary," Lourdes said, "this airport essentially has unrestricted access in and out. No flight plans required, no passenger or cargo manifests required, nothing like that."
"That's about right," O'Connor said.
"And there's no way to tell where that plane, the Grand Caravan, is heading?"
"Well, that depends. You're supposed to fly with your transponder on. If he's following the rules, then he's got the transponder on, and that will register as the plane moves through airspace from one ATC region to the other."
"Can you get that in real time, like right now?"
"No. We would need to get the unique transponder code from the plane and put out the request. Might take a day, maybe longer."
Lourdes looked at Bosch. He nodded. He had nothing more to ask.
"Thank you, Mr. O'Connor," she said. "We appreciate your cooperation.
We would also appreciate if you would keep this conversation to yourself."
"Not a problem," O'Connor said.
Bosch and Lourdes waited until they were back in the car before discussing what they had learned in the last hour.
"Holy shit, Harry," Lourdes said. "I mean, where the fuck's TSA when you need them? Somebody could just get in a plane here, load it up with whatever they want, and fly it downtown to a water reservoir or whatever, and do who knows what."
"Scary," Bosch said.
"No matter what, we need to tell somebody about this. Leak it to the media or something."
"Let's see how it figures into our thing before we get the media crawling all over this."
"Got it, but speaking of our thing, where to next?"
Bosch thought for a moment. "Downtown to the Reagan. Let's go talk to your medical board guy." Lourdes nodded and started the engine. "Jerry Edgar. He told me he was LAPD back in the day." Bosch shook his head once in surprise.
"What, do you know him?" Lourdes asked.
"Yeah, I know him," Bosch said. "We worked together in Hollywood back in the day. I knew he retired, but I thought he was selling houses in Las Vegas."
"Well, he's back here now," Lourdes said.
Chapter 11. The Medical Board of California had offices inside the Ronald Reagan State Office Building on Spring Street, three blocks from the LAPD headquarters. It was a 45-minute slog in heavy traffic down from Pacoima. Along the way, Lourdes had called Jerry Edgar and said that she and her partner were on their way to see him. When Edgar balked, saying he had a meeting to attend and wanted to set up an appointment, she identified her partner as Harry Bosch, and Edgar couldn't refuse. He said he would clear space in his schedule. They parked in a pay lot, and Edgar was waiting for them in the lobby of the state building, He greeted Bosch warmly, but with an awkward embrace. It had been several years since they had been in each other's company, professionally or otherwise. The last message Bosch could remember coming from Edgar was one of condolences about Bosch's ex-wife several years before. Bosch had heard that his old partner had retired after that, but he had not gotten an invite to a retirement party, though he did not know if there had actually been one. Still, they had cleared several cases together while assigned to the homicide table at Hollywood Division. Now there wasn't even a homicide unit in Hollywood. All murders were handled out of West Bureau Detectives, or RHD. Things change. It was said among cops that a true test of a partnership came when there was an officer needs help call. The response is to drop everything and go, pinning the accelerator to the floor and blowing through traffic lights with a siren blaring to get to the officer in need. True partners each take one side of every intersection as they speed through. The driver takes the left, the passenger takes the right, each calling out clear as the car screams through red lights and intersections. It takes an inordinate amount of trust not to cheat and check the other side, even as your partner calls it clear. With a true partner, you don't need to check the other side. You know. You believe. When Bosch and Edgar were partners, Bosch always found himself checking the other side of the street. An outsider might view it as a distance forged in the racial divide between them. Edgar was black, and Bosch was white. But for each man it was something else. Something well below the skin. It was the gap between how each man viewed the job. It was the difference between how a cop works a case and a case works a cop. But none of that surfaced as the two men smiled at each other and tentatively hugged. Edgar's head was shaved now, and Bosch wondered if he would even have recognized him if he hadn't known it was his old partner. "Last I heard, you pulled the pin, moved to Vegas, and were selling real estate," Bosch said. "Nah," Edgar said. "That lasted about 2 years and I came back here. But look at you. I knew you'd never be able to give it up. But I thought you'd end up with the DA's office or something. SFPD. They call themselves the Mission City, right? That's perfect for Harry Bosch." Lourdes smiled and Edgar pointed at her. "You know what I'm talking about," he said, smiling.
"Harry's always the man on the mission." Edgar dropped a smile and the subject when he read Bosch's frozen look, as a hint he was pushing the main difference between them too far. He signaled them to follow him into the elevator alcove, and they moved into a crowded box. Edgar pushed the button for the fourth floor.
"Anyway, how's your daughter doing?" he asked. "She's in college," Bosch said, "second year."
"Wow," Edgar said. "Crazy."
Bosch just nodded. He hated carrying on conversations in crowded elevators. Besides, Edgar had never met Maddie, so it was clear that they were now down to idle banter. He said nothing else as they rode up. They got off on the fourth floor, and Edgar used a keycard to enter a suite of offices with a large government seal on the wall that showed a seven-pointed star surrounded by the words California Department of Consumer Affairs. "My crib's back here," Edgar said.
"Are you Consumer Affairs?" Lourdes asked.
"That's right. Health Quality Investigation Unit. We handle enforcement for the medical board." He led them to a small private office with a crowded desk and chairs for two visitors. Once they were sitting, they got down to business.
"So this case you're working," Edgar said, "do you think it's linked to the complaint one of your victims sent to us?"
Edgar looked at Lourdes as he spoke, but Bosch and Lourdes had agreed on the ride down that Harry would take lead in the meeting, even though Bella had first made contact with Edgar. Bosch had the history with Edgar and would know best how to work the conversation to their advantage. "We're not 100% on that yet," Bosch said, "but it's getting there. The whole thing was on video, and our read on it is this was a hit disguised as a robbery. Two shooters, masks, gloves, in and out, no brass left behind. We're looking at the kid as the target, and that brings us to the complaint he sent. He was a good kid, no record, no gangs, most likely to succeed sort of kid. Just out of pharmacy school. He and his father were at issue about something, and it might have been filling prescriptions from that clinic. The sad irony here is that the kid probably went to pharmacy school on money the old man banked filing shady scripts," Edgar said.
"That is sad," Bosch said.
"So what happened with the kid's complaint?"
Okay, Edgar said. Well, like I told Detective Lourdes, the complaint landed on my desk, but I had not acted on it yet. I pulled it up when we spoke, and judging by the date it was sent and received, this thing was gathering dust in Sacramento for about 5 or 6 weeks before they took a look at it and sent it down here to me. Bureaucracy. You know about that, right, Harry?
Right.
The statute of limitations on these offenses is 3 years. I would have gotten to it sooner rather than later, but the harsh reality is, it would have been a couple of months before I'd have acted on it. I've got more open files than I can handle. He gestured to the stacks of files on his desk and a shelf to his right. Like everybody else in this building, we are critically understaffed. We are supposed to have 6 investigators and 2 clerical support slots in this unit to cover the whole county, but we have 4 and 1, and they added half of Orange County to our territory last year. Just driving down and back to the OC on a case takes half a day. Edgar seemed to be going out of his way to explain why the complaint hadn't been followed up on, and Bosch realized that it was because of their prior history. Bosch had been so demanding as a partner that Edgar always felt under pressure to perform, and after all these years, he was still making excuses and trying to justify himself to Bosch. It made Bosch regretful and impatient at the same time.
We understand all that, Bosch said. Nobody's got enough bullets. That's the system. We're just sort of trying to jumpstart some stuff here because we've got a double murder.
What can you tell us about this clinic over in Pacoima that the pharmacist was complaining about?
Edgar nodded and opened a thin file on his desk. It had a single page of notes on it, and Bosch got the feeling that Edgar hadn't done much with it until Lourdes called and mentioned Bosch and that they were on their way downtown.
I checked it out, Edgar said. The clinic is licensed in doing business at Pacoima Pain and Urgent Care. The doctor who owns it is listed as Ephraim Herrera. But then I checked his DEA number and he...
What's a DEA number? Bosch asked.
Every physician needs a DEA number to write prescriptions. Every pharmacy is supposed to check that on the script before putting pills in the bottle. There's a lot of abuse with phony numbers and stolen numbers. I checked Dr. Herrera's number, and he wrote no prescriptions at all for 2 years and then came back with a vengeance last year and has been writing them like a madman. I'm talking hundreds a week.
Hundreds of pills or hundreds of prescriptions?
Prescriptions. Scripts.
As far as pills go, you're talking thousands.
So what's that tell you?
It confirms that the place is a pill mill, and no doubt the kid pharmacist's complaint was on target.
I know you told Bella some of this already, but can you school me a little bit? How does a pill mill, how does all of this work?
Edgar nodded vigorously as Bosch asked the question, jumping at the opportunity to show some expertise to the man who had always doubted him.
They call the people involved in the mills cappers, he said. They run the show, and you need unscrupulous doctors and pharmacies in the mix to make it all work.
The cappers are not the doctors or pharmacists? Bosch asked.
No, they're the bosses. It starts with them either opening a clinic or going into an existing clinic in a marginal neighborhood. They go to a dirtbag doctor, somebody just decided having their license revoked. A lot of docs that worked in the medical marijuana joints are perfect candidates. The capper goes in and says, Doc, how'd you like to make $5,000 a week for a couple mornings in my clinic? That's good money for somebody like that, and they sign up.
And they start writing prescriptions.
Exactly. The cappers line up the shills in the morning, and they get their scripts from the doctor. No good faith physical exam, nothing legit about it. And then they go out and get in a van, and the capper drives them to the pharmacies to get the pills. Usually it's more than one pharmacy in cahoots, so they can spread it out and try to fly under the radar for as long as possible. A lot of them have multiple IDs, so they hit 2, 3 places a day, and it doesn't come up on the computer. Doesn't matter that the phony IDs are for shit, because the pharmacist is in on it. He doesn't look too close at anything.
And then the pills go to the capper?
Exactly right. Most of these shills, they're addicts themselves. That capper is the straw boss, and he reports to somebody down the line, and he's got to make sure nobody guzzles those pills. So he keeps everybody in the van, and they hit the pharmacies, maybe 2 going in at a time, and they turn those pills over right away when they get back to the van.
The capper will front them what they need out of the day's haul to maintain their addiction and keep them working. He keeps them high and keeps them moving. It's a trap. They get in and they can't get out.
Bosch thought about the man in the sunglasses with the goatee who was driving the van of old people that he and Lourdes had tailed.
What happens next? Bosch asked.
The pills get distributed, Edgar said. They hit the streets, go to the attics, 55,000 dead, and counting since this all started. Almost as many as we lost in the Vietnam War.
That is sadly quantifiable.
But the money?
Forget it. It's off the charts. So many people are making money off this crisis. It's the growth industry of this country. Remember what they used to say about the banks and Wall Street being too big to fail? It's like that, but too big to shut down.
David and Goliath, Bosch said.
Worse than that, Edgar said. Let me tell you one story that, to me, says it all. Opiate addiction, in case you don't know, clogs the pipes. It stunts the gastrointestinal tract. Bottom line is, you can't shit. So one of the big pharmaceutical companies comes up with a prescription laxative that does the job and costs about 20 times what your over-the-counter laxative runs. The next thing you know, the pharma stock goes through the roof. They're selling so much of this that they're advertising on national television. Of course, they don't say dick about addiction or anything like that. They just show some guy mowing the lawn and, oh, he can't shit, so get your doctor to give you this. So now you've got Wall Street invested and the national media selling ads. Everybody is making bank, Harry. And when that happens, it can't be stopped.
I thought they were trying to change things in Washington, Lourdes offered. You know, new laws putting a big focus on this?
Not likely, Edgar said. The farmers are major campaign contributors. Nobody's going to bite the hand that feeds them.
Edgar seemed to be using the national picture to justify his own local inertia. Bosch wanted to keep the focus small for the moment. You always start small and go big.
So going back to this particular case in Pacoima, the capper got to Dr. Herrera. He went from signing no prescriptions to doing hundreds.
That's right. And these are big prescriptions. 60 pills, sometimes 90. There's nothing subtle about it. I pulled his records, and he's 73 years old. It looks like he retired, and they brought him back, reopened the clinic, and put a prescription pad in front of him. For all we know, the guy might be senile. We've seen that. They dragged some schnook out of retirement because he's still got that DEA number and a license to practice. You want to make an extra $20K a month, and so on.
Bosch was quiet as he tried to digest all the information. Edgar went on, unprompted. Another thing they do with these old doctors is they go through all their old records and pull legit names to phony up IDs and Medicare cards. They use real people who have no idea their names are being used in all of this. The government thinks the subsistence requests are legit.
That's crazy, Lourdes said.
So then what do you guys do about it? Bosch asked.
When we can identify it, we can shut the doctor down, Edgar said. We work with the DEA to get the number revoked, and then we yank the license to practice, but it's a long administrative process, and most of the time these cappers have moved on to the next guy. A guy like Ephraim Herrera is left holding the bag. Not that I have any sympathy for the doctors, but the real villains here are elusive. I don't have to tell you how frustrating that is.
I can see that. The pill shields, have you heard of them being moved around by plane?
Bosch asked the question casually, but it came out of the blue and gave Edgar pause. Bosch read in the hesitation that they might be onto something out of the routine with the Esquivel case.
Is that what you have up there? Edgar asked.
It looks like it, Bosch said. We followed a van from the clinic to Whiteman Airport, and several people were loaded onto an old jump plane. It took off and headed south. They didn't file a flight plan. We checked with the tower. Guy said the plane comes in and goes out every day. The clinic is right across the street from the airport. The fuel bills from Whiteman go to a company down in Calexico, Lourdes added.
Bosch could see a change come over Edgar, an added level of concern working its way into his eyes and the deep set of his brow. He leaned forward and put his elbows on the desk.
Things make a little more sense now, he said.
How so? Bosch asked.
I mean, as far as killing the kid.
One of the biggest operators in the pill mill business in the country is a Russian-Armenian syndicate. Most of the pills that come out of these small operations go to them, and they feed Chicago, Las Vegas, all the hot spots. Bosch threw a sideways glance at Lourdes. O'Connor at the Whiteman Tower had said the pilot spoke with a Russian accent. Lourdes exchanged eye contact and then returned attention to Edgar, who was still talking. Supposedly they use planes to keep people in motion, hitting multiple clinics and pharmacies a day, he said. The planes help keep the shills in circulation, cashing out scripts for pills. Like I said before, they have multiple IDs, and they're moved through 3-4 pharmacies a day. We are talking big money, and with big money comes big danger. This kid had no idea what he was bringing on when he decided to stand tall.
They would hit him just to send a message? Bosch asked.
Entirely possible. If you ain't filling my scripts, you ain't filling nobody's scripts like that.
Where is the syndicate based? Here?
You need to be talking to DEA, Harry. This is a whole different level.
I'm talking to you, Jerry. Tell me what you know.
Not a lot, Harry. We handle enforcement for the medical board, man. This isn't an organized crime unit. What I heard through my contact at drug enforcement is that they're out there in the desert.
Which desert? Las Vegas?
No, down toward the border in Calexico. Out near Slab City, Bombay Beach, that no man's land they call the south side of nowhere. There are all kinds of airstrips down there, abandoned by cartels, even the U.S. military. And that's what they use when they're flying people around. Out in the middle of nowhere, it's like a gypsy caravan or something. They stay mobile. They sense trouble. They move like fucking nomads.
What about names? Who runs a syndicate?
Some Armenian guy who uses Russian enforcers and pilots. He calls himself Santos because he looks Mexican, but he isn't. And that's all I've got on that.
If they know where these people are and what they're doing, why don't they move in and take them down?
That's a DEA question, man. I wonder the same thing. I think it's Santos. They want him, and he's like smoke.
Give me a name at the DEA.
Charlie Hovan. He's their expert on Armenian drug dealers. He told me his family Americanized the name from Hovanian or something like that.
Charlie Hovan. Thanks, Jerry.
Bosch looked at Lourdes to see if she had anything else to ask. She shook her head. She was ready to go. Bosch looked back at his old partner.
So we'll leave you to it, he said. Thanks for the cooperation.
Bosch stood up and Lourdes followed.
Harry, there's a story about Santos, Edgar said. I don't know if it's true, but you should know.
Go. The DEA flipped one of his shills. The guy was an oxy addict, and they leveraged him. He was supposed to keep working the game and feed intel back to the narcs.
What happened?
Somehow Santos figured it out or got wind of it. One day the informant got on the plane with a bunch of other shills and took off for a day's work. But when the plane landed, he wasn't on it anymore.
He got tossed.
Edgar nodded. They've got the salt and sea down there, he said. Supposedly the high salt content of the water chews a body up pretty quick.
Bosch nodded. Good to know what we're dealing with, he said.
Yeah. You two watch yourselves out there, Edgar added.
Chapter 12. After leaving the meeting in the Reagan building, Bosch and Lourdes walked over to the Nickel Diner on Main Street for a late lunch. Bosch was a regular at the restaurant when he had worked downtown for the LAPD, but had not been back since he'd left the department. Monica, one of the owners, welcomed him warmly, and still remembered his routine order of a BLT sandwich. Bosch and Lourdes discussed the information they had gotten from Edgar, and debated whether to reach out to the DEA agent they had gotten a line on. Ultimately, they decided to wait until they had a better handle on their case and knew more about the activities surrounding La Farmacia Familia and the clinic in Pacoima. They still had nothing connecting the two things other than Jose Esquivel Jr.'s complaint about the clinic. On the drive back up to the valley, Lourdes took a call from Sisto, who said he had found a few things during his review of video from the pharmacy cameras that he wanted everybody on the team to see. Lourdes told him to set it up in the war room, and they'd be back by 4. Exhaustion started to settle over Bosch as the car moved slowly in early rush hour traffic. He made the mistake of leaning his head against the passenger door window, and soon he was out. It was the buzzing of his phone in his pocket that woke him up a half hour later.
Shit, he said as he dug the phone out.
Was I snoring?
A little bit, Lourdes said.
He answered the call before it went to message. He was still disoriented from sleep when he mumbled his name into the device.
Yes, sir, this is Officer Jericho with San Quentin ISU. Did you say you are Detective Bosch?
Yes, Bosch, that's me.
Lieutenant Menendez asked me to handle an inmate research request and get back to you.
The inmate is a Preston Ulrich Borders?
Yes, what have you got?
Bosch reached in his pocket for a notebook and pen. He tilted his head to hold the phone between his ear and shoulder and got ready to write.
Not a lot, sir, Jericho said. He only has one approved visitor, and that is his attorney. His name is Lance Cronin.
Okay, Bosch said. Do you have any crossouts? People who used to be approved?
This is off a computer, sir. We don't have crossouts.
Okay, do you have a visitation history with the lawyer?
Yes, sir. Shows he received approved visitor status in January last year. He's made regular visits on the first Thursday of every month ever since. Except he missed December last year.
That's a lot of visits, isn't it? I mean, that's like 14 or 15 visits so far.
I wouldn't know what would constitute a lot of visits, sir. These guys on death row get a lot of legal attention.
Okay, what about mail? Did the lieutenant ask you to see what was going on with mail that goes to Borders?
Yes, he did. I reviewed that, sir. An inmate Borders receives about 3 pieces of mail per day, and it goes through a review process. He has had mail rejected because the letters were pornographic in nature or contained pornography. Nothing else unusual.
Do you keep any sort of entry log for knowing who is sending the mail to him?
No, sir, we don't do that.
Bosch thought for a moment. The results of his request to Menendez were coming up dry. He looked out the windshield at a freeway sign and realized he had slept through almost the entire drive back to San Fernando. They would be on McClay in 5 minutes. He took a long shot on one last tack with Jericho.
You said you're on a computer, right? He asked.
Yes, sir, Jericho said.
Can you look up inmates anywhere in the DOC system or just San Quentin?
This is the system-wide database.
Good. Can you look up another inmate for me? His name is...
Lieutenant Menendez didn't ask me to check multiple inmates.
That's okay, I can hold while you ask him.
There was a pause while Jericho decided whether he really wanted to ask his lieutenant if it was okay to look up another name.
What is the name? He finally asked.
Lucas John Ulmer. He's probably listed as deceased.
Jericho asked Bosch to spell the full name, and he heard typing.
Yes, deceased, Jericho said. D.O.D., November 9th, 2015.
Okay, Bosch said. Is there still an approved visitor list on the file?
Hold one.
Bosch waited.
Yes, Jericho finally said. He had 5 visitors approved.
Give them to me, Bosch said.
He wrote the names Jericho recited in his notebook. Carolyn Ulmer. Peyton Fournier. Wilma Lombard, Lance Cronin, Victoria Rempel. Bosch stared at the list. One was obviously a family member, and the other women were probably prison groupies, women attracted to a man of danger as long as the danger is incarcerated. Only Cronin's name was important. The lawyer currently representing Preston Borders had previously represented the now-dead inmate who supposedly committed the murder that Borders was held on death row for.
How did you know, Jericho asked.
Know what, Bosch said.
That the lawyer was on both visitor lists.
I didn't, until now.
But it was an obvious thing to check, and Bosch knew Soto and Tapscott had to have made the same connection as well. And yet it had not hindered the conclusion that Borders was innocent in the killing of Daniel Schuyler. Bosch knew he needed to get the file and review the second half, the recent investigation.
He thanked Jericho for his time and asked him to pass on his appreciation to Lieutenant Menendez. He then put both his phone and notebook away.
Harry, what's going on? Lourdes asked.
It's a personal matter, Bosch said.
It's not related to our case. It is if it's keeping you up at night and you're falling asleep in my car. I'm an old man. Old men take naps. I'm not kidding. You need to be on your game for this. Don't worry. It won't happen again. I'm on my game. They drove in silence the rest of the way to the SFPD station. They entered the detective bureau through the side door and immediately went to the war room where Sisto, Luzon, and Trevino were waiting. What you got? Lourdes asked. Take a look, Sisto said. He was holding the remote for one of the screens. There was a frozen image from the camera over the prescription counter at La Farmacia Familia. Sisto hit the play button. Bosch first noticed the time and date stamp. The video was recorded 13 days before the murders. Everyone stood in front of the screen in a semicircle to watch. On the screen, Jose Esquivel Sr. was standing behind the counter, his fingers on the computer keyboard. A customer stood on the other side of the counter, a young woman holding a baby. There was a white prescription bag on the counter. While the customer transaction was taking place, a man entered the store through the front door. He was wearing a black golf shirt and sunglasses and had a goatee. Bosch immediately recognized him as the man he and Lourdes had seen driving the van from the clinic to Whiteman Airport that morning, the capper. He went along two of the aisles and idly perused the shelves as if he were looking for something, but it was clear he was waiting. Esquivel finished his computer work and handed what appeared to be an insurance card back to the woman holding the baby. He then handed her the prescription bag and nodded as the interaction was completed. The woman turned and left the store, and then the man in the black shirt stepped up to the counter. There was no sign of Jose Jr. in the store. The playback was without sound, but it was clear from the body language and hand gestures that the man in black was angry and began to confront Esquivel. The pharmacist took a step back from the counter to put some space between himself and the angry visitor. The visitor first held a finger up like he was saying, "One more thing," or "one last time." He then pointed it at Esquivel's chest and leaned across the counter to drive home the point. That was when Esquivel apparently made a mistake. He gestured with his own hands in defense and started to say something. It appeared that he was engaging in the argument, verbally pushing back. Suddenly the visitor's arm shot out and he grabbed Esquivel by the lapel of his lab coat. He jerked the pharmacist forward and half over the counter. He then got right in his face, their noses inches apart. Esquivel went up on his toes, his thighs braced against the edge of the counter. He instinctively raised his hands to show contrition and that he was not resisting. The visitor held him in the awkward position and continued to talk, his head jerking in a paroxysm of anger. And then came the moment Sisto wanted everybody to see. The visitor raised his left hand and formed a gun, forefinger pointing and thumb up. He put the finger against Esquivel's temple and pantomimed shooting him in the head, his hand even jerking back to show the recoil. He then pushed the pharmacist back over the counter and released his hold. Without another word, he turned and walked through the pharmacy and out the front door. Jose was left disheveled and trying to pull himself together. Sisto raised the remote to stop the playback. "Wait," Bosch said. "Let's watch him." On the screen, the pharmacist paced for a moment behind the counter. He rubbed his face with both hands and then looked up as if asking the heavens for guidance. His face was clear on the overhead camera angle, and Jose Esquivel Sr. seemed like a man carrying a tremendous burden. He then put his hands on the edge of the counter and leaned down. Everything about his face and body language said, "What am I going to do?" Finally straightening up, he opened a drawer in the counter. He took out a pack of cigarettes and a throwaway lighter. He pushed through the half door to the back hallway and out of sight, presumably going to the back alley to smoke and calm his nerves. "Okay," Sisto said. "Then there's this." He fast-forwarded the video playback for 20 seconds and then returned to normal play. Bosch checked the time counter as Sisto narrated. "This is 2 hours later on the same day," the young detective said. "Watch when the sun comes in." On the screen, Jose Sr. was standing behind the pharmacy counter looking at the computer screen. His son entered the business through the front door and walked behind the pharmacy counter. As he pulled his pharmacist coat from a hook
Jose Sr. looked up from the screen and waited for his son to turn around. An argument ensued between the father and son, with the father making pleading gestures, hands clasped together as if in prayer, and the son looking away, even shaking his head. It ended with the son removing the coat he had just put on, and days later would be murdered in, and throwing it into the air as he stormed out of the store. Once again the father was left leaning against the counter, supporting himself by both hands and shaking his head in dismay. "He saw it coming," Luzon said. They all took seats at the big table to talk about what they had seen and what it meant. Lourdes looked at Harry, and they exchanged nods, a silent communication that they were on the same page. "We think we know who the guy in the black shirt and the shades is," she began. "Who?" Trevino asked. "He's what they call a capper. He works for a clinic operating as a pill mill. We saw him today driving people around. People who take illegitimate prescriptions to pharmacies like the Esquivel families. We think the father was neck deep in the whole thing, and the son was probably trying to get them out of it." Trevino made a low whistling sound and told Lourdes to fill in the story. With Bosch pitching in here and there, she proceeded to bring the team up to date on their activities during the day, including the Whiteman angle and the visit with Edgar downtown at the Reagan building. Trevino, Sisto, and Luzon asked few questions and seemed duly impressed by the progress Lourdes and Bosch had made on the case. Halfway through the session, Chief Aldez entered the war room, pulled out a chair, and sat down at the end of the table. Trevino asked if he wanted Bosch and Lourdes to start at the top, and Valdez demurred, saying he was just trying to catch some of the update. When Lourdes concluded her report, Bosch asked Sisto if he could put a freeze frame of the capper on the screen next to a freeze frame of the killers in the pharmacy. It took Sisto a few minutes to accomplish this, and then everyone stood in front of the screens to compare the man who had threatened Jose Esquivel Sr. to the men who had killed him and his son. The conclusion based on body size was unanimous. Neither of the killers was the man who had threatened Jose Sr. Additionally, Lourdes noted the capper had used his left hand to pantomime shooting Jose Sr., while the two shooters had held their weapons in their right hands. "So," Trevino said, "next moves?" Bosch held back, letting Lourdes take the lead, but she hesitated. "Search warrant," Bosch said. "For what?" Trevino asked. Bosch pointed to the man in black on the video screen. "My read is that he threatened to kill Esquivel, and then those two guys were brought in to actually do the job," he said, pointing to the second screen. "What we're hearing is that this organization is operating south of here and uses planes to move people around. We get a search warrant to look at video at Whiteman going back maybe 24 hours from our shooting. We'll see if they flew the shooters in." The police chief nodded, and that made Trevino follow suit. "I'll write the warrant," Lourdes said. "We can take it over there tonight before O'Connor leaves." "Okay," Bosch said. "Meantime, I'll try to make contact with Edgar's guy at the DEA. Maybe they already have a line on our shooters." "Can we trust the DEA with this?" Valdez asked. "The medical board guy happens to be my old partner," Bosch said. "He vouched for the guy, so I think we're good." "Good," the chief said. "Then let's do it." After the meeting ended, Bosch walked out to the parking lot before heading over to his desk in the old jail. He grabbed a copy of the Schuyler case file out of his car and carried it with him across the street. It was time to go back to work on it. Chapter 13. As expected, Bosch's call to DEA agent Charlie Hovan was not accepted. It had been Bosch's experience over many years that DEA agents were a different breed of federal law officers. Because of the nature of their work, they were often treated with suspicion by others in law enforcement, as had been exhibited earlier by Chief Valdez. It was odd and unwarranted. All law officers deal with criminals. But there was a stigma attached to drug agents, as though the scourge of the particular crime they fought could rub off on them. Lie down with dogs, get up with fleas. It was a phenomenon most likely rooted in the need for infiltration and undercover work in so many drug investigations. That stigma left agents paranoid, isolated, not interested in talking on the phone with strangers, even if they were law enforcement,
and it could be argued that they were all part of the same team protecting society. Bosch suspected that he would not hear back from Hovan, unless there was a pressing need on the agent's part. Harry tried to give him that with one sentence left on the agent's voicemail. "This is Detective Bosch with the San Fernando Police Department. I'm looking for some intel on a guy who calls himself Santos and flies a plane in and out of an airstrip up here, where we just had a double murder in a pharmacy that was filling opioid scripts for him." Bosch left his phone number before disconnecting. He still believed that he might need to call Jerry Edgar in a day or two and ask him to vouch for him with Agent Hovan in order to prompt a simple conversation. Bosch knew that it would probably take Lourdes a couple hours to write up a warrant for the Whiteman video archives and then get a telephonic approval from a superior court judge. It would take longer if she could not find a judge. The courthouses were closing now, and most jurists would soon be in their cars, commuting home. Bosch's plan was to use whatever time he had to dig further into the Schuyler investigation. Despite the double murder being the priority of the moment, Bosch could not stop thinking about the Schuyler case and the threat it posed to his public reputation and private self-worth. In his career, he had chased down hundreds of killers and put them in prison. If he was wrong about one, then it would put the lie to everything else. It would cast him adrift. He first had to push the file boxes from the Esmeralda Tavares case to the side. When he lifted one box to put it on top of another, a photo dropped onto his makeshift desk. It had slipped through a separation in the bottom seam of the box and had fallen out. Bosch picked it up and studied it. He realized he had not seen it before. The photo was of the baby daughter, who had been left in the crib when her mother went missing. Bosch knew she would be 15 or 16 now. He'd have to get her exact birthday and check the math on that. A year after the mother's disappearance, her father decided he could not raise her. He turned her over to the county's foster care program, and she was raised by a family that adopted her and eventually moved from Los Angeles up to Morro Bay. The photo reminded him that he had long planned to go up there to find her and talk to her about her mother. He wondered if she had any distant memories of her natural mother and father, but it was a long shot, and he had never made the trip. He put the photo on top of the contents of the box, so it would serve as a reminder next time he checked into the case. Bosch split the Schuyler files in half and put the stack of copies from the original investigation to the side. He then started reviewing the chronological record that Soto and Tapscott had begun keeping once assigned to reinvestigate the case. It quickly became clear that the new look at the Schuyler case began with a letter sent 7 months earlier to the Conviction Integrity Unit from the man who was the nexus between both sexual predators involved, Attorney Lance Cronin. Bosch put the chrono aside and looked through the stack until he found the document. It was on Cronin's letterhead, showing his office address on Victory Boulevard in Van Nuys. The letter was directed to Kennedy's boss and the head of the CIU, Assistant District Attorney Abel Kornblum. "Mr. Kornblum, I write to you today in hopes that you will follow your sworn duty and right a terrible wrong and miscarriage of justice that has plagued our city and our state for 3 decades. It is a wrong that in some ways I helped propagate and extend. I now need your help fixing this. I currently represent Preston Borders, who has resided in death row in San Quentin State Prison since 1988. I took on his representation only recently and, quite frankly, solicited him as a client. Attorney-client privilege in another case has prevented me from coming forward until this point. You see, until his death in 2015, I represented Lucas John Ulmer, who was convicted of multiple counts of sexual assault and abduction in 2006 and sentenced to more than 100 years in prison. He served that sentence until his death from cancer at California State Prison, Corcoran. On July 12, 2013, I had occasion to meet with Mr. Ulmer at Corcoran to discuss potential grounds for a final appeal of his conviction. During the course of his privileged conversation, Mr. Ulmer revealed to me that he was responsible for the murder of a young woman in 1987 and that another man had been falsely convicted of the crime and sentenced to death. He did not name the victim,
but said that the crime had occurred in her home in Toluca Lake. As you will understand, this was a privileged conversation between attorneys.